Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for April 7th, 2017. This is one of the signature pieces of music for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. It's the Roman Carnival Overture by Berlioz, and you're hearing the orchestra's most recent performance of it from last Saturday night. We had it for you live on the radio last week, and now you can hear it on demand when you visit us online at classicalwcrb.org. Alain Altinoglu was the conductor, and the program also included Lalo's Symphonie Espagnole with violinist soloist Renaud Capuçon, Dutilleux's Symphonie No. 2, Le Double, and the second suite from Roussel's Bacchus et Ariane. The Lalo and Roussel are also available to hear on demand, but publisher restrictions keep us from making the Dutilleux available. The good news is that the entire concert will be on the radio next Monday, beginning at 8 p.m. I personally didn't know the Dutilleux before last week, and now that I do, it really seems like a piece we should hear more often, especially from the BSO. Also on demand at our website is WCRB in Concert with Mistral. Kathy Fuller brought you parts of two concerts by Julie Skolnick's Chamber Ensemble last Sunday, and once you've heard the broadcast on demand, I hope you'll make time in your schedule this weekend to hear the group live. They've got two concerts, one on Saturday and one on Sunday, both at 5 p.m., so you could even make it a doubleheader if you want to get to another concert afterwards. And the program is fantastic. Copland's Appalachian Spring in the original version for 13 instruments, Ravel's Le Tombeau du Couperin in an arrangement for chamber ensemble, and Arnold Schoenberg's arrangement of the Emperor Waltz by Johann Strauss II. Very fun stuff. As for our radio programs this weekend, on Sunday at 7 p.m., WCRB in Concert with Emmanuel Music features Bach's St. Mark Passion. It's a piece for which the music is completely lost. So you may ask yourself, how did they perform it? And that question is answered on this podcast by Emmanuel Music Artistic Director Ryan Turner and Harvard University's Christoph Wolf. Tomorrow, on Saturday, we will not have a live BSO broadcast from Symphony Hall because the Boston Symphony is not playing. The Boston Pops is performing, and it's an all John Williams program. They're recording it for release next month, so you'll have a chance to hear it soon. In the meantime, on the radio tomorrow at 8 o'clock, you'll hear a fabulous all-Czech Boston Symphony program recorded last year with conductor Ludovic Morlot and cello soloist Johannes Moser. When Emmanuel Music performs Bach's music, the singers and instrumentalists draw on an incredible amount of experience with it. It stems from the combination of the weekly Sunday services of Emmanuel Church, where the ensemble has made Bach cantatas a regular part of the liturgical landscape since the early 1970s, and the ensemble's annual concert series. And about a year ago, Emmanuel performed, for the first time, Bach's St. Mark Passion. It's understandable that it was the first time because the music for it is lost. There have been a few reconstructions over the years, but Ryan Turner, the artistic director of Emmanuel, wanted to create a new one. He and Christoph Wolf, a professor emeritus at Harvard and one of the world's leading Bach scholars, got together to apply the latest knowledge and research to come up with something like what Bach probably wrote. When I got together with the two of them to talk about it, I began by asking Christoph how we know that the St. Mark Passion even existed.
We have the printed libretto, and we also have the date for the performance, because the printed libretto indicates that it was performed in Leipzig under Bach's direction in 1731. But this is really all we have. We have not a single note of the piece.
That makes performing it a big challenge. So it requires that a lot of detective work be done, and I think a lot of speculation has to be applied to what that text might have sounded like, what the music might have been. So have there been other reconstructions or speculations about what the music could have been?
There have been quite a few over the years, over the decades, I should say. And they are more or less successful because you cannot really reconstruct the piece on the basis of finding out what music Bach might have used or reused for the St. Mark Passion. Also, when he reused something, he tends to rewrite. He tends to improve things. He tends to make adjustments. He cannot copy himself without making changes. And I think that needs to be taken into consideration.
Ryan, with that level of uncertainty and difficulty, what made you sort of really want to get Emmanuel Music into performing a St. Mark Passion? Any particular version? We'll get to the particular one that you did, but what was it that attracted you to doing the St. Mark Passion?
The historical core, I guess you could say, of what we think might have been the music is this Trauer Oda, Cantata 198. This is, I think, some of Bach's most brilliant writing. It's sort of almost an exotic orchestration with two gambas, two flutes, two oboes, not a combination he uses ever again. And I was drawn to it for that reason. And it's not a piece that really works in Emmanuel's liturgical life of presenting the cantatas. And that was if we knew we had these outer choral movements plus three arias as sort of the thing that we could hold on to as something that may have been true, that was what drew me to it, as well as the fact that, you know, we have coming up on a near 50-year history, and we've never performed this piece or attempted to, and it seemed to me a challenge that we were ready for.
And Christoph, the Trauer Oda that Ryan references, how do we know that that was the core of the music Bach reused for the St. Mark Passion? What's the evidence that we have about that?
What we can tell is that Bach, at the time he composed the St. Mark Passion in the 1730s, early 1730s, he had been engaged in quite a number of commissions for the courts, for other private people, to write birthday cantatas, funeral music, and the like, for very special occasions. And Bach was trying to make sure that the very good music he wrote would not just be shelved away, but he could use it for repertoire purposes. And, you know, a funeral ode was written for a one-time occasion. A passion could be performed regularly. So since a mourning piece and a passion relate to, you know, the same kind of musical substance, it really lended itself to Bach's consideration for turning the music into something that could become a repertoire passion. And then you look at the arias, as you can tell from the metric schemes used in the poetry. The five arias in the funeral ode match the related arias in the St. Mark Passion. So if you have Lass Fürstin, lass noch einen Strahl, param, 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 param. Geh, Jesu, geh zu deiner Pein, is the first line in the St. Mark Passion. And you have the number of lines and the rhyme order and all of that that matches perfectly the kind of texts that you have for the funeral ode and for the St. Mark Passion. You can tell also by the contents of the poetry that whoever made the parody, and in this case we know it was Bach's house poet by the pen name Picander, Johann Heinrich Henrici. So he did this, and he knew how to work for Bach so that Bach could use the same music for a different text that would project the same emotional content.
Okay, so that's very high-level detective work, it feels like to me, because you have to look at all these different possibilities for what could match, and you finally arrive at this one piece that has, you know, the core, as you say, Ryan, of the St. Mark Passion, that these things do match. That must have been a great discovery for the person that came up with that. But then
it came up for, you know, a long time ago. It happened over 100 years ago.
Yeah, okay. And so, Ryan, then that leaves still a lot more that's not clear. So we have the sections of the funeral ode that match up with certain parts of the text, and then there are all these other parts. And as I understand it, the chorales could be assigned. You could figure out the particular chorale tunes used with the text based on CPE Bach's collection. Is that right?
To an extent. I mean, we knew the chorale texts.
Yeah.
And then there are a number in CPE Bach's collection, a number of chorales. And what I sort of did is I found the most, some tunes that were specifically assigned and then tried to find more compelling tunes for the emotional affect of that point in the Passion. I find the most challenging part of this whole St. Mark Passion is how to take care of the music for the recitatives.
That was my next question, because we sort of start with the core and we go out from there, and the recitatives are where there's nothing that we can say that we know, so they just have to be created.
Exactly, and that number of... There are a number of solutions that have been done. There are recordings of the St. Mark Passion that the gospel text is simply read.
Ah, okay.
And yeah. I believe even as recent as 2 years ago, King's Chapel did a performance of the St. Mark Passion by reading the gospel text.
Okay.
We know that Bach performed a Passion by Reinhard Kaiser in, and Christoph, you have to correct me, I think it was 1712.
Well, 1716. I mean, the Passion was older, but I think the performance that is documented is from 1716.
Mm-hmm. And in Weimar. We also know that he did this Kaiser Passion more than once, I think up to three or four times during his lifetime. So what I chose and what a number of scholars have chosen to do is use that as for the recitatives, both for the evangelist and the accompanied recitatives for Jesus. The other thing that's interesting about the Kaiser is that one can conjecture that Bach's inspiration for the accompanied recitatives for Jesus in the St. Matthew Passion were the accompanied recitatives that Kaiser did for Jesus in the St. Mark Passion.
Ah, okay.
So this is a convention that Bach, we know he used in the St. Matthew, and the St. Mark is after the St. Matthew. So that's another sort of impetus for using the Kaiser. The problem with the Kaiser, other than the fact that it's not Bach...
There's that little problem.
Yes, is that his narrative begins in the Mark Gospel after the move to the Mount of the Olives. But the aria and chorus texts that Picander has provided us, as well as the Gospel readings, go back earlier to the Last Supper.
Right.
So we don't have recitatives, any written music for that bit of gospel narrative.
Okay.
There was in the 90s a English conductor, musicologist, Simon Hayes, who wrote recitatives in the style of Kaiser to fill in the missing narrative. So that is what I chose to use because I felt like it created the most coherent musical recitative narrative that would create a whole to get us to the end of the piece.
And it does all add up. I mean, it comes across as a complete passion. And yes, we know that a lot of the music isn't by Bach himself, and we can conjecture maybe some ways that even that Trauer Ode, those pieces that match perfectly the text, what would have Bach really done to the music to improve it, as you say, Christoph, because he always improved everything when he used it again. But it does add up to a complete picture. So Christoph, how does the Mark Passion then compare in its emotional content, in its trajectory, to the passions that we have for Matthew and John, that we do have complete pieces by Bach? What does the Mark do that's different from those pieces?
That is the most difficult aspect to deal with.
Okay.
Because if you think of Bach's St. Matthew and St. John passions, what is special about it is not the arias and the choruses and the chorales, because you have them in the cantata as well. What you do not have in any cantata is the kind of dramatic narrative, the dialogue between, the various participants in the Passion narrative. And, the way Bach deals with that is so fundamentally different from any other composer. Take Telemann, take Handel, take Kaiser, the older generation. We would be curious how, after the experience of St. John and St. Matthew, Bach in 1731 would have dealt with the same assignment. So we have no idea in which direction he would have gone. So that's, in a way, a very sad admission to the listening of a coherent musical whole. And it really worked extremely well. Still, it leaves a disappointed Bach fan, you know, because we do not know how he would have dealt with this exciting assignment of writing new dramatic narrative in order to glue the arias and choruses together.
And Ryan, exciting. I'm glad you said that, Christoph, because this text is exciting, but in a kind of scary way. I find the trajectory and the characters and the way that they are portrayed in this to really have quite a bit more than the Matthew or even the John in terms of the sort of sinister quality, the conspiracy, the way that Jesus is, you know, railroaded into his fate. It feels scarier to me. I don't know if that's how it strikes you, but I wonder, knowing the John and the Matthew as well as you do, how did this text change your approach to the Passion in order to conduct it, in order to bring it across in a performance?
You know, we as conductors of Bach, we all are, as you hint at, very intimately familiar with the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Matthew and how Bach sets it. Admittedly, the Gospel of Mark was not something on my radar or that I had knowledge of. So I met with, in fact, the Emmanuel rector, Pam Wernz, to sort of bone up on my Mark knowledge, as it were. And one of the things that I discovered about Mark's portrayal of Jesus, and it's important to remember that these Gospels, Mark was the first Gospel to be written, followed by Matthew and Luke, and the final Gospel written was John. So there's a sort of, I think I mentioned this in my notes, this workmanlike, almost, Jesus is presented almost very blue-collar. And there's a sense of him figuring this out as he goes along. When you compare it to the St. Matthew Jesus, who's really about this idea of building community, where, and the John Jesus, I think, is very much everything is as it was fulfilled in the scriptures. He is divine. There's no doubt from the very beginning. Where the Mark, you're not really sure where he's going because he makes mistakes. He's figuring it out as he goes along. And I think that's inherent in the music. And that's was part of my own inspiration for wanting to do this St. Mark Passion, is that Mark's Jesus isn't as polished as the other ones, and neither was this performance because there was so much about it we didn't know.
Yeah.
And we were figuring it out as we went along. You know, I think about what I call Judas's aria. It really isn't, but there's the falsche Welt, the false world, about deception. And that, which was came from a very early cantata, cantata 54,
Widerstehe.
Yes. That is one of those powerfully uncomfortable moments in the piece that I think you reference.
Yeah. I'm glad you say blue collar, because it is so direct. It feels, from a listener standpoint to me, like I'm getting kind of grabbed by the collar and pulled.
Well, and in, of course, the Mark Gospel, we get a sense that Jesus is never completely understood by his disciples.
Uh-huh.
And I think that struggle is inherent in the relationship. They don't completely get this until the Gospel narrative plays itself to the end.
The composer, Bach in this case, is always beginning as a reader. So he looks at the text and he studies the St. Mark Gospel. And he is aware of much of what Ryan just indicated, that this is a very different narrative from St. Matthew and St. John. You know, the St. John has real theological depth. And, you know, the opening chorus indicates that, you know, with Herr unser Herrscher, Lord our ruler. So it's projecting, you know, the kingdom of Jesus. And the majestic style of the St. Matthew Passion is also very different from the St. John. And the St. Mark is a much more modest, is a quieter piece, is a more down-to-earth piece. And you can tell from the fact that Bach in the funeral ode is using a different orchestra, a smaller orchestra dominated by two viola da gambas, two flutes, transverse flutes, and two lutes. I mean, of course, the regular strings are added to that, but it's a very different kind of orchestral color. And I would say all we know about the possible musical differences is related to that kind of a different orchestra, a scaled down projection of the sound from comparing it with the St. John and the St. Matthew.
This really brings to mind a question on my part that maybe Bach didn't really have too much control because the gospel is dictated by a lectionary. So Bach is given a particular thing in any given year. He's given a set of readings that he works with. But after having already done the John and the Matthew, then this is the third one he does. And I wonder why he didn't start with this one. There's probably no evidence to indicate why he might have started first with, I think it was John that was the first, and then the Matthew was second, but he waited until he got to the Mark. And yet it's a smaller scale, as you say, a more workmanlike interpretation of Jesus. Do you have any thoughts about why he might have waited to get to the Mark until after the others?
Well, I think, going back to my statement, Bach as a reader, he found the St. John and the St. Matthew passion narrative more interesting,
fascinating
as a composer, because it offers more material, more differentiation. And so I think since he reperformed both the St. John and the St. Matthew, he wanted to do something entirely different.
That's really interesting because the 1731, this is when he has gotten through his initial cycles of Sunday cantatas. And he's at this point in his life where he is looking to bigger challenges. He's looking into those larger scale pieces that are going to come, you know, down the line in the next decade and a half or so. And so now that kind of makes some sense from knowing the character of Bach and the kind of person he is for whatever we say about the character of the Mark, it's a bigger challenge to a composer, I guess, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And also, I think, you know, after the St. John and St. Matthew Passions and after, you know, several annual cycles of cantatas, Bach is also making stylistic changes. So I think he enters a new era. And I think it's from that point of view that the dramatic design of the biblical narrative is a huge loss because we don't have the musical realization.
Yeah. Ryan, I have to ask about one aria in particular. It's the one that really struck me the most as an emotional touchstone of the piece, and that is the bass aria with the chorale that comes towards the very end, Welt und Himmel. And this is one of those instances, and it happens in lots of other of Bach's sacred works, where there's an aria with interjections of a chorale. And so the sopranos are singing the chorale tune, and then the bass soloist takes particular verses of an aria, and they combine. And it's always, every time Bach does this, it's just incredible because you have these simultaneous messages. And I guess the main thing I'm curious about did Peekander's text indicate that this is how that would be arranged? Or was this just something that you thought, yeah, I'll do that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in a number of the reconstructions, that was not the aria, the music that has been presented.
Okay. People made other choices for
other
that aria than this one.
And the aria was what Bach wrote for his second version of the St. John Passion in 1725. And I felt that, obviously the text, the metric scheme of the text scans in beautifully to that aria. And there's something about the, at that point in the piece, the drama lends itself, as the experience you had, I think, to that chorale tune coming in to having a profound effect.
Oh, it profound is the right word for it. Mm-hmm. It just has this emotional weight to it that is remarkable.
And, you know, I think there's something about Pilate in this point, because this aria is really sort of a reflection on Pilate's interrogation of Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, and I think in all three Passion narratives that we know, not counting the Luke, there's so many different ways Pilate is presented. Sometimes he's somewhat strapped by the Roman government in that he's just doing his job, right?
He's just doing his job.
You know, in St. Matthew, we see him, I think, as trying to simply prevent a riot.
Yeah, right.
And in St. Mark, to me, there's something a little bit more. There's a moment where we see him truly, I think, personally question this. Where am I as a person in this? And I think you don't see that in John or Matthew, I don't think. I think this is the only time we see maybe, you know, a tiny window into Pilate's soul, which we really don't want to see. But,
but it's there.
It's there, and I think that's the turmoil of this aria.
Wow. That's fantastic.
This aria is not related to the funeral ode.
Okay.
Because it was added in the 1740s, which is an interesting fact, because Bach is revising the St. Mark and expanding it.
Oh, so this is a revision of the St. Mark.
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we do have a libretto, which was found only 8 years ago. Of a booklet that was used for the performance of the St. Mark in 1744 at the St. Thomas Church. We don't know whether it was the third or fourth performance of the piece, but it clearly indicates, because Bach makes some changes in the organization of the text and adds two arias. He is working on improving, you know, the piece, as he did with the St. John and the St. Matthew. You know, we have revised versions of these pieces from the 1730s. And I think in that context, he's also going back to the St. Mark and, you know, putting finishing touches on it. And, you know, that's a new challenge for us now when it comes to reconstructing the music.
Well, and I should mention this discovery he was talking about. It was in the Russian National Library in St. Petersburg in 2009, where they discovered this booklet from 1744. And we discovered two other arias, too. So what we thought were only five arias, the 1744 version actually gives us eight arias. So this was the other challenge, is we have three new Madrigalian texts for arias, and we have to find music for them.
Yeah, and you don't have those earlier models to draw from.
Right.
Yes.
And
wow.
There are no texts where we have exact matches, as in the case of the funeral ode.
Yeah.
So it's very tricky.
They
may have been original compositions. I think, you know, Bach had an easier time to quickly write an aria from scratch rather than trying to, you know, fit new text under old music.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's fascinating. And that fits as well with what we know about how Bach approached his work, that this was in a time when he was about revising. He was looking so far beyond. He was looking beyond his own life and trying to consolidate. I didn't even realize that we're dealing with a text that is even that recently discovered. Christoph, you've been around for and done some discoveries. I mean, you have seen these things happen before, many times. Is there any chance, do you think, that we're ever going to find even part of the music for the St. Mark Passion?
I wouldn't exclude it, but I think it's very, very unlikely because it is a big score.
Okay.
That doesn't get lost so easily.
Yeah.
And whoever is the owner wouldn't want to keep it a secret, because it is a treasure. And if someone holds back this kind of stuff, I think it's entirely unrealistic to believe that it is somewhere.
Was Bach a completist about his passions in the same way he was about so many other things? Do we know whether he wrote a St. Luke Passion so that he would have had all four of the of the Gospels covered for his Good Friday services?
We have a St. Luke's Passion in his hand, but it's a work by another composer, and we unfortunately do not know his name. But it's a good piece. Bach performed it for the first time, as far as we can tell, in 1730. That is a year before the St. Mark. He added a few things to it. We do have the score of this piece, so we know what kind of music for, you know, the purpose of a Good Friday Passion performance he liked. So that's an interesting piece of evidence, but it doesn't tell us anything about his own compositional style.
So there's no way that we can know whether he actually wrote a Luke.
No, unlikely.
Unlikely. Okay. Ryan, it's been a little while since you performed it last year, and I just wonder, on reflection, how that experience stands in your memory of the totality of your conducting of Bach's pieces. I mean, where does this sort of fit in for your own experience? Is it a quirky little sidebar, like there's this reconstruction, but we don't really know, or did you find this piece to be a little bit more central to your understanding of Bach even?
I don't know if I would say it was central to my understanding of Bach, but what I found, Christoph mentioned this earlier, that the St. John Passion has 11 chorales. The St. Matthew Passion has 13 chorales. The St. Mark has 16 chorales. When you add in the overlay that we did in that aria you mentioned earlier, the Welt und Himmel,
yep,
the Passion chorale there, we have 17 chorales. I've, for years now, been drawn to the way Bach uses the chorales in his cantatas, of course, which we encounter weekly, but also in the Passions and the Christmas Oratorio, and especially in this, because we don't know exactly what the tunes would have been, but we do know these, metrically speaking, these were, if I can say, oddities and a real departure for Bach from his other Passion settings. I mean, they're odd phrase lengths, different harmonizations, chorales that, in fact, our choir didn't know. I remember that first rehearsal, and they were a little dumbfounded. What is going on? What is this all about? And even some different harmonizations of chorales that they knew. Of course, the chorales are, to me, I see them as the sort of colloquial sort of response of the people,
yeah,
a way to bring it back to Bach's congregation. These were tunes they probably would have known. And so to me, that is the most compelling thing about this, is the use of the chorales. And why did he choose so many, and why so many different melodies that he hadn't explored before?
That just makes my mind kind of spin with conjecture, right? I mean, because, I mean, yeah, the chorales are the vernacular of the congregation and meant to be so. And so by using that many more in this piece, if you combine that, somehow set that next to the idea of, as you put it, the blue-collar Jesus, what are we talking about? I mean, that's... Anyway, Christoph, you were going to say...
Well, I think it's an interesting case, because the chorales also put us on safer ground with respect to the aspect of Reconstruction. Because some 20 years ago, we've relocated in Leipzig, at the Bach Archive, a manuscript by a Bach student. We know his name, Johann Ludwig Dietl. He compiled in 1735 a collection of chorales, which was completely neglected because we have the published chorale collections by C.P.E. Bach. So this was just considered a collection of chorales, which duplicates the same chorales in the C.P.E. Bach collection, but the way it is compiled is interesting. There is a block of chorales from the St. John Passion, a block of chorales from the St. Matthew Passion, and then a block of chorales which are identical with the texts of the St. Mark. So this is really solid evidence that in 1735, not all 16 chorales, but, you know, a good block of chorales were copied by Dietl from Bach's score of the St. Mark Passion, because he was a collector of chorales. So he took them from cantatas and the large-scale works. And so, you know, for more than a handful of chorales in the St. Mark, we would know these were the chorales specifically written for that passion.
This just makes musicology sound like so much fun. Because really, that's
it just, is fun.
That's such that's such great connecting of dots, and it still leaves you that tantalizing little gap between what we truly can know and what we think we know, and it just it's really fun. Ryan, do you see this this reconstruction, even if it gets tweaked, revised, whatever? I mean, is this going to be part of what Emmanuel does now? This is, you said that the Mark had never been done by Emmanuel Music, but now there it is. So will it take its place with the Matthew and John as every few years, as you go through the passions, that it'll come back? I mean, do you see it as that kind of piece, or does the lack of authentic Bach argue against using it a lot more?
Well, I guess my answer is yes to both questions.
Fair enough.
I don't believe this would ever sort of find its way in a 4 or 5 year cycle of our major Bach choral masterworks.
Okay.
I would and definitely entertain the idea of doing it again and making some tweaks here and, you know, revisiting it. I would say across the board for our musicians, the opportunity to engage in this way with an unknown piece was exciting and challenging as well. And I would say that for me as a conductor, you know, of course, to teach our musicians and explore this with the collective years of experience on that stage,
yeah,
which is a little, daunting at times when you think about the collective years of experience out there, that they hadn't done this. I must say, as a conductor, it was incredibly exciting to engage in this piece with them in that way.
It must have, you must have, they must have brought so much of their voices, their own knowledge of playing Bach, that I can't imagine you must have had some revelations during rehearsals. Like, I didn't think about that.
Oh, well, that's every week I have those revelations. I do, you know, you come into a rehearsal with a singer and you have an idea about the affect, the tempo, the character of an aria, and the singer has a totally different idea. And often you say, wow, yeah, that's better than the thought I had. So that's, you know, the sort of collaborative nature of Emmanuel is what's,
yeah,
I think, the most thrilling part about it. Yeah. And, you know, looking at these arias that were they were all cantata arias, and revisiting them with a different text and in a different dramatic context is a very interesting exercise too, because you have to sort of shed yourself of any ideas you have as these pieces exist in the cantatas and to completely rethink. Every one of these cantata arias I had conducted in a cantata.
Sure.
And now to revisit them with new text in a different dramatic context is an interesting adventure as well.
Yeah. Ryan Turner and Christoph Wolff, it's so good to have you here, and I could continue to talk about this for hours. I think we'll stop there, though. So thank you for being here, Ryan.
Thank you, Brian.
And
thank you.
Thank you so much. Ryan Turner is the artistic director of Emmanuel Music, and Christoph Wolff is the Harvard professor who literally wrote the book on Bach. Okay, lots of people have written books on Bach, but among Christoph's several is Bach, The Learned Musician. It's really the definitive biography, and it is magnificent. If you haven't read it, do yourself a favor and pick it up. And tune in on Sunday night at 7 p.m. for WCRB in Concert with Emmanuel Music. That's when you'll hear the St. Mark Passion that we just spent around 35 minutes talking about. If you don't know either of Bach's other passion settings, this might be a good one to hear, especially because of all the chorales you heard Ryan talking about. And if you do know the St. John and St. Matthew Passions, I think you'll find this St. Mark Passion pretty fascinating. And by the way, the libretto and more information about the piece is available when you visit our website, classicalwcrb.org. As I mentioned, the BSO is off this week, so we won't have a live broadcast from Symphony Hall tomorrow night. Instead, we're bringing you one of my favorite concerts from last season, when Ludovic Morlow conducted Smetana's The Moldau, Martinu's Sixth Symphony, and the Cello Concerto by Dvorak. The soloist is Johannes Moser, whom I talked with during that week of concerts. I began by asking him if he had any memories of hearing the Dvorak for the first time.
Oh, I have a very strong memory of this. I started cello when I was 8 years old, and when I turned 9, I got tickets to see the Dvorak Concerto with Heinrich Schiff in Munich. And I don't remember much of the performance, but I remember a relatively small person entering the stage furiously with a red head, and then as soon as he started playing, he turned purple. And that, as a 9-year-old, really was engraved in my brain. I'm sure the music was glorious, as I'm really a fan of his playing, but certainly that memory stuck very, very much to me.
Yeah, and you know, as a person just starting out on the instrument, it must have had a huge impact. But that sort of points to the fact that the Dvorak is one of the most played of cello concertos for very good reasons. You just recorded it about a year ago. What did you do to sort of, I can't imagine there's not baggage that comes with you along the way with Dvorak at any time. What did you do to separate from that to really make the recording you wanted to make?
Well, baggage, I think, is really the word that is hitting it on the head, because there are so many fantastic recordings out there, recordings that I grew up with. I mean, just to name a few, Rostropovich, Yo-Yo Ma, Jacqueline Dupré, all these recordings that I had in my, you know, I was growing up with them. And so I thought, you know, if I want to make another recording, I need to distance myself from these recordings and I need to find my own voice. And so I did a couple of things. I stopped listening to recordings of that piece, basically 1.5 years before, to sort of clean my system. And I really revisited the score, not only like, you know, throwing away my old parts and buying new ones and really making a new edition of myself, but I also bought the facsimile of the autograph of the piece. And reading through Dvorak's handwriting was really a key for me, because I saw how much struggle it was for Dvorak to put this piece on paper. You see passages being crossed out, you see passages being replaced, you even see comments, you know, after a passage composed on October 19, and by the way, I had borscht for lunch, and then there was a huge thunderstorm in the evening. I mean, you find really real life information in this score, you know, and suddenly this divine masterpiece gets a touch of humanity. And I think that was something that took sort of I still have huge respect for this piece, but it took a little bit the angst away of approaching this piece and making a statement on recording.
And do you feel like this piece sort of has more to gain from that sort of experience, a sort of almost as close as you can get to a firsthand contact with a composer who's been dead for a long time? Do you think this piece has more to gain than maybe some other pieces of music that you would play?
That is hard to say. I mean, I do the same thing with the Elgar Concerto, by the way. Okay. But Elgar's writing is pristine. Yeah, just like Richard Strauss or Hindemith. Or Mozart, for that matter. I mean, these were people that were able to channel the music beforehand and just write something, you know, perfectly crafted in their mind. Whereas the key to Dvorak is much more craftsmanship, in the sense of working on it as we go through it. So I think that seeing that firsthand is really an eye-opener.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing about Dvorak, I've only been able to visit Prague once, and yet I found it completely enrapturing and felt like there was a resonance with the music that very few locations have with the music associated with them. You've been to Prague to record the concerto. Had you been there before, and did those surroundings sort of inform you even further as you performed it?
You know, it was actually my first visit to that city, not even as a tourist, and which is really, you know, shameful, because obviously I lived in Berlin for 15 years, and really it is just a 3-4 hour train ride to go to Prague. So, you know, everything in Europe is so close. But it really was my first time going to that city, and it was a little bit of a shock, you know, to see that beauty, to see how well preserved everything is, you know, how people are proud of their heritage there. But seeing Prague is only one side of the medal. I think what really informed me the most was to work with Czech musicians and to just not even talking about the music so much, but really per osmosis, you get so much of their style, of their understanding, and how they just breathe and live their music, you know. I think that is something to be said for Czech musicians, is that they are incredibly proud of their musical heritage, you know, and rightfully so, because some of the most glorious music comes from that country.
As we're hearing in this concert, absolutely. For sure. Yeah, the whole concert. And it's too bad that Jiří Bělohlávek couldn't be here. Is he someone that you had worked with before?
I have not, actually. It's a funny story, because I auditioned for Bělohlávek about 15 years ago. And I did a lot of conductors auditions, and he was one of the first ones. And he was sitting there in the Leipzig Gewandhaus together with a skinny kid that was accompanying him. And it turns out that kid was actually Jakub Ruscha, with whom I would then, you know, 14 years later, record the Dvořák Concertos. Yeah. So we already made contact early on. This would have been my first musical encounter with Bělohlávek, and as sad I am that we are not going to share the podium after all this time. I am absolutely thrilled that Ludovic Morlot has agreed to do this concert. We had the first rehearsal today, and he is absolutely amazing in the way that he can shape the orchestra in this really truly symphonic piece. You need somebody with symphonic understanding, and that is what he has.
Yeah, and he's so well loved around here that the relationship is built in because of his history with the BSO. Your own history, you are the child of parents who are musicians. You started very early, as you mentioned, 8 years old, you started the cello. Was it therefore sort of just, did you always have the feeling that this is the path you would be taking, or was there a moment when you decided, I'm now going to make a commitment to music as what my calling is going to be for the foreseeable future, at least?
Right. Well, you know, there was a very strong will to become an astronaut when I was 9 years old. So, I mean, I had to overcome that period first. And then it was private detective, I think. So, you know, once I overcame the will to do these jobs, I thought music would be my next option. You're absolutely right. Coming from a musician's family does sort of put a stamp on your future a little bit. So I think what my parents were able to show me is how to live a musician's life and still have a normal life at the same time. Because I think, you know, so much of the idea of the traveling virtuoso of the 1800s, you know, with long hair like Paganini and Liszt, you know, not paying tribute to any sort of schedule and just being totally free-spirited, that is not a reality in musician's life. I mean, you need to be more like a sports person. You need to be incredibly rigid about, you know, about food, about sleep, because the travel is just so intense. So my parents were able to show me that very very, very clearly. But I mean, you know, it's not only my parents that started that musical tradition. I mean, my aunt Edda Moser, you know, was a very, very known soprano. My grandfather worked together with Richard Strauss, and my great grandfather worked together with Josef Joachim and Johannes Brahms on, you know, creating together with Josef Joachim, he created a violin school, and he also met Brahms a couple of times. So my family has been involved over you know, a long period of time with sort of the German music scene, and I mean, hey, no pressure, right?
No, it's
a weird heritage to start working out in, but at some point, of course, you just realize, hey, everybody for himself, and you just have to really make your own way, and this is what I'm trying to do.
Okay, so that makes my next question maybe even a little bit more fun to think about. So this long history of musicians in your family, a real legacy of encounters with the greatest musicians of the German heritage. Your generation, though, is dealing with a completely different world. What did you decide, or what have you come to know that you need to do differently as a musician from those previous generations to be able to communicate what you want to communicate, or to carve your way through this world? What do you have to do differently?
So I think what is both amazing and also really challenging about my job is that every place is different musically, you know, and with our sort of, you know, jet set possibilities in travel, I encounter a different sound world literally every week. I mean, January has been a little bit crazy. I mean, I started out in London with Hocidal, and then I went to Chicago with the Chicago Symphony, which of course has a completely different sound than the following week, which was Paris, you know, much more fragile sound, much more colors. And then coming here to the Boston Symphony, again, another amazing different sound world. And so I think it is hugely important to really open your ears every week and have a fresh approach to the repertoire that you're playing. Because if you play, you know, I mean, I play Dvorak very much. And if I play it the same everywhere I go to, it will not pay tribute to where I'm actually playing, you know? So then it's it becomes almost generic, you know, in a way. And so I need to constantly reinvent my views with what I hear. So this is an incredibly, you know, demanding process, but it's also very, very exciting to be able to do that. And yeah, with the possibilities of fast travel, you need to be able to sleep when you have those 7 hours and not be haunted by sleeplessness and all those kind of things. I mean, that is also a big challenge. And I'm not necessarily sure if just because we have the possibility of all this travel, we really need to take advantage of it in the way that we do. You know, also maybe being a little bit more conscious about the environment and all that. But it's just like that in this way, and we'll see how that develops.
Yeah, well, and I've always wondered how much various soloists are affected in what they're playing by the orchestra that's there with them. And you're saying that's actually a really significant factor for you as you play the Dvorak with different orchestras.
Absolutely. And I think to believe that playing as a soloist is a one-way street is an absolute illusion. I think the times of the autistic soloist just doing her or his thing on stage and not caring about the world and the surroundings, those times are over. That also goes for conductors, of course. I mean, I think when the Berlin Philharmonic hired Abado and they were on first name terms, you know, after dealing with Karajan in sort of a godlike fashion, and then also, you know, around the world having young music directors that meet the musicians really on the same level, on the same playing field, I think that demands also for soloists to do exactly the same thing. So we are really collaborators, you know, as Julius Caesar said, primus inter pares. So that means like the first one under equals, you know, and the with the accent on equals, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so you bring up Julius Caesar, and I understand that there's there's a lot of other ways you spend your time. What is the most powerful non-musical informant or inspiration for your work as a music? Does anything cross over from the other things you do to help you with your particular approach to music?
I think it starts with making breakfast and you know, watching the news, as gruesome and terrible as it is right now, to, you know, going to a museum or reading a book. I mean, right now I'm reading a fantastic book by Max Frisch, and just to constantly sort of keep the brain entertained, shall we say. But I think there is no way of saying, okay, now I'm going to the museum in order to enhance my performance of the Haydn concerto. I think if you put a purpose to the non-musical activities, you really destroy that purpose, you know, and you really destroy also the pure pleasure of art consumption, you know. And really, sometimes I feel a physical need to go and see a good exhibition of contemporary art, and then it really nourishes me in a great way. But I would never say, "Hey, today I really enhanced my understanding of Lutoslavsky because I saw some Kandinsky, you know. So and I think that's a wonderful thing of the brain and the soul for that matter, is that you don't have to make it your purpose in order to enhance your personality or your views. It goes automatically if you're just open and you are allowing influences to affect you.
Johannes Moser, it's great to have you back in Boston. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
Thank you so much.
Johannes Moser is the soloist in Dvorak's Cello Concerto in an encore broadcast of the Boston Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night, beginning at 8 p.m. And that's it for this episode. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find TAQ on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Ryan Turner and Christoph Wolf, as well as to Johannes Moser. And thanks also to the staffs of Emmanuel Music and the Boston Symphony for making these conversations possible. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.